Testing one. Today is October 3rd, 2009. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Today is the Mid-Autumn Full Moon Festival, right? So it's just in the Western calendar, just the beginning of autumn. Okay, so now we are coming to the very last section of Chapter 10. The last section of this book, and today will be the last class in this course that's been going on for 2 years now. Okay, and now I come to the section on page 417. This is called The Powers and Grounds of Self-Confidence. These are considered to be the special qualities that are distinctive of a Buddha. Some of the disciple arahats have these powers of knowledge to some extent, but it's said that in their fullness, in their completeness, in their full breadth, range, they are special to the Sammasambuddha, the fully, completely enlightened one. Okay, so in this sutta, the Buddha is speaking to Venerable Sariputta. This is sutta number 12 in the Majjhima Nikaya called The Larger Discourse on the Lion's Roar. Okay, and so it says that the Tathagata has these 10 Tathagata's powers, possessing which he claims the place of the chief, it's actually the chief bull of the herd, roars his lion's roar in the assemblies and sets rolling the wheel of Brahma. What's meant by the wheel of Brahma is actually the same as the wheel of Dhamma. So it's the wheel of the teaching, which the Buddha is the one who sets the wheel of Dhamma in motion, and then the disciples keep the wheel turning over the generations. Okay, so what are these 10 powers? There are actually 10 powers of knowledge special to a Buddha. Okay, and so first, the Tathagata correctly understands the possible as possible and the impossible as impossible. There is another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's called Bahudhatu Sutta, the discourse on many elements. And in that sutta, the Buddha explains things that are possible, things that are impossible. And so some of the things that are impossible would be for an action which is unwholesome, motivated by greed, hatred, or delusion, to bring forth pleasant and agreeable results. So that's impossible. It's impossible for an action which is wholesome, motivated by generosity, by kindness, by understanding, to bring forth painful, disagreeable results. It's impossible for a person who has attained to right view, that's the right view of a stream enterer, to take the life of his mother, take the life of his father, take the life of an arhat, maliciously wound a Buddha, or to maliciously cause a schism in the Sangha. But it's possible for one who hasn't achieved this right view to do those actions. So this, I don't have to go through all of these possible and impossible things, but these are just a few examples of things that are possible and impossible that illustrate this particular knowledge of a Buddha. Okay, then the Tathagata correctly understands the results of actions undertaken, past, future, and present, by way of possibilities and causes. Actually, I just touched on this when explaining what is possible and impossible. But what this means is that the Buddha understands all the different types of karmas that are possible, karmic actions. He understands what are the roots of these actions, what do they spring from, what are the underlying psychological causes of different types of actions, karmic actions, and he knows what are the results of these types of actions. He understands how certain types of actions will become the causes for generating rebirth. He understands how certain other actions, other karmic actions, will support the karma that creates the rebirth. Other types of karmas will tend to counteract the karmas that create the rebirth. Other types of karmas will produce results in the course of a life. Other types of karmas will counteract those karmas that produce results in the course of a life. So there's a wide variety of types of karmic actions, and the Buddha understands what these actions are, what are the causes from which they spring, and what are the results that they produce. Third, the Tathagata correctly understands the ways leading everywhere. Okay, this in a way is almost an extension of the second knowledge. Here, the Buddha understands what are the types of actions, the types of karmic actions that lead to rebirth in each of the five realms of existence. What types of karmas lead to rebirth in hell? What type of karma leads to rebirth in the realm of animals? What kind of karma leads to rebirth in the realm of the afflicted spirits? What kind of karma leads to a human rebirth? What kind of karma leads to rebirth in the heavenly realms? Then what kind of karma leads to a rebirth in the Brahma realms, the formless realms? All of this comes within the scope of the knowledge of a Buddha. And he understands this not just by conceptually, but because he sees the power of these actions directly. He directly sees the power of these actions to lead to rebirth in these different realms. Okay, fourth, the Tathagata correctly understands the world with its many and different elements. Here the word translated as elements is dhatu. And the word dhatu actually can have two translations into English. It actually suggests two ideas. One is the realms of existence by way of the three, what is called the three primary realms. That is the sense sphere realm, the form realm, and the formless realm. The other idea suggested by the word dhatu are the constituent factors that make up experience. Usually these are explained as the 18 dhatus, the 6 sense faculties, the 6 sense objects, and the 6 types of consciousness based upon those faculties and those objects. But I think here probably the word dhatu has an even broader meaning and will refer to all of the dharmas, the phenomena that constitute the world. So this would include the Buddha's ability to analyze experience of the world into the 5 aggregates, the 6 or 12 sense bases, the 18 elements, and to be able to know which kinds of aggregates, sense bases, elements arise in the sense sphere realm, which kinds of aggregates, sense bases, elements arise in the form realm, which aggregates, sense bases, and elements arise in the formless realm. Okay, these first four powers of knowledge of the Buddha pertain to his understanding of, you could say, processes that occur in the world. But now comes two knowledges that pertain to the Buddha's understanding of sentient beings in general. So the fifth is that the Tathagata correctly understands how beings have different inclinations. Because the Buddha is a teacher and has to function as a spiritual guide, so he has to understand all of the mental dispositions, capacities, inclinations, tendencies, interests, aptitudes of the people that he's teaching. And so the Buddha doesn't only understand that beings have different inclinations, interests, and tendencies, but when people come to the Buddha for instruction, the Buddha, using this power of knowledge, is able to directly understand their minds, to know what are the tendencies in their minds, what are their interests, what are their inclinations, how he should teach them in the way that will be most effective, most beneficial for that particular person or those particular people who are to be instructed. So sometimes, for example, the Buddha will be teaching a group of farmers, then he'll understand the inclinations, tendencies, interests of these farmers, and so he'll formulate his teaching in ways that will be meaningful to them. He might use similes of planting a field, sowing the crops. One doesn't sow the crops, one sows the seeds, harvests the crops, to illustrate points in his teaching. If he's teaching Brahmins, then he might use the simile of, for example, tending the sacred fire in order to appeal to the Brahmins. If he's teaching people from the Kshatriya class, he might use analogies and similes from warrior culture. The brave, courageous warrior who enters the battle, who's not deterred by the enemies, the horses, elephants, troops of the enemy. And then he understands which beings are inclined to, when he's teaching, which have a greater tendency to sensuality, to lust, who is inclined to anger, to hatred, who is disposed to faith, who is disposed more to intellectual type teachings, so who has a more ascetic temperament, who has a more self-indulgent temperament. So the Buddha can understand all of these different mental inclinations of the people he's teaching. Okay, the sixth knowledge seems a little similar to this, but I think it's probably intended more specifically. And this is the Tathagata correctly understands the disposition of the faculties, of other beings, of other persons. So it's said that he understands whose faculties are inferior, whose faculties, spiritual faculties, are moderately developed, and whose spiritual faculties are well developed or superior. And this is said with reference to the five spiritual faculties. These are the faculties of faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. So people in their previous existences have practiced, many have practiced the Buddha Dharma, and they've developed these faculties to some extent. And some have placed more emphasis, for example, on the faculty of faith, less on the faculty of wisdom. Others have placed more emphasis on the faculty of wisdom, less on the faculty of faith. And so the Buddha, when he teaches people, he knows what is the relative strength of their faculties, which faculties have to be developed in them, which faculties are already well developed. And so on this basis, he knows how to instruct them in a way that will precisely correspond to their needs, to their dispositions, and help them to develop. Okay, the seventh knowledge pertains to the Buddha's mastery over the domain of meditation. So the Buddha correctly understands the defilement or corruption, the cleansing, that's the purification, and the emergence in regard to the jhanas, these are the four jhanas, the liberations, these are eight other meditative states, the eight liberations, the different concentrations or samadhis, and the attainments, meditative attainments, samapattis. These are just different terms which refer to basically to the four jhanas, the four formless meditations, and the attainment of cessation of feeling and perception. Okay, so the Buddha understands what are the defilements, like what are the barriers to be overcome to enter these meditative attainments. For example, the five hindrances are the main obstacles to the progress of meditation. What is the cleansing? How does one purify or overcome those barriers, those obstacles, in order to reach the attainments? And then how does one emerge or come out from these meditative attainments? One has to be able to enter them, to abide in them as long as one wants, and then to emerge from them. Okay, the next three types of knowledge, the three types of knowledge that the Buddha achieved on the night of his enlightenment, and these knowledges are attained by many of the Arahat disciples. So the Buddha has them, it's said, to the first two, to a superlative degree. The eighth is the knowledge of previous lives, so the Buddha is able to look back and to see his previous lives, even in detail, over many aeons, many cosmic aeons. The ninth, this is called the divine eye, or the knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. So the Buddha is able to look out at the, over the world, and he sees beings passing away and taking rebirth in accordance with their karma, and he understands how the results that beings reap in their new lives, whether they arise in inferior states and superior states, whether they're beautiful or ugly, fortunate, unfortunate, rich, poor, healthy, unhealthy, long-lived, short-lived, and so on, how this results from their previous karma. And then the tenth power of knowledge is the knowledge of the destruction of the asavas, of all of the defilements. And so he realizes for himself with direct knowledge in this present life, and he enters upon and dwells in the liberation of mind, liberation by wisdom that is taintless with the destruction of the taints. So this is his knowledge of his own destruction of all defilements. Okay, so these are the 10 powers of knowledge of the Tathagata. Then in addition to this, there are four other qualities that he has, which are called the four grounds of self-confidence. Okay, so now we're in paragraph 23. He says, I see no ground on which any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva or Mara or Brahma or anyone else in the world could, in accordance with the Dhamma, accuse me thus. While you claim to be perfectly enlightened, you are not perfectly enlightened about these things, the Pali word here is these dhammas. Some interpreters, even the commentator, take this to be a kind of claim to omniscience. But I don't think it has to be or should be understood in the sense that the Buddha is claiming to know all the facts about the world. That would strain my own credulity. But I think what this means is that the Buddha understands all of the principles that are essential to the spiritual life, all of the principles that govern the workings, all the laws that govern the workings of samsara processes, and all of the laws relevant to the attainment of enlightenment and liberation. Okay, the second power, or second ground of self-confidence, is that nobody can say to the Buddha, while you claim to be one who has destroyed the asavas, the taints or defilements, there are certain defilements that you have not destroyed. Okay, so with this claim, with this ground of self-confidence, the Buddha is claiming that he has absolutely destroyed all of the defilements. Okay, the third ground of self-confidence, there are certain things that the Buddha has called obstructions to progress along the path. And here somebody might say to the Buddha, those things that are called obstructions by you are not able to obstruct one who engages in them. So the Buddha has laid down certain things like the 5 hindrances to be obstructions to progress. So if somebody indulges freely in the 5 states called the 5 hindrances, there's no possibility that those states will not obstruct him. Okay, then the fourth ground of self-confidence is the self-confidence that the Buddha's teaching, the Dhamma, will lead to liberation or to the extinction of suffering. So the Buddha says, I see no grounds on which any ascetic and so on, anyone at all, could accuse me thus. When you teach the Dhamma to someone, it does not lead him, when he practices it, to the complete destruction of suffering. So with this, the Buddha declares his confidence in the ability of the Dhamma to lead one who takes it up and practices it to the complete freedom from suffering. Okay, and so those are the Buddha's 4 kinds of self-confidence. Okay, let's go on just and we'll finish the whole chapter, then I'll ask the questions. Okay, the next section, there's not really much to discuss, but it's just the use of a particular simile. which shows the special function of the Buddha in the world. So it says that just as the sun and moon, so long as the sun and moon have not arisen in the world, there is no manifestation of great light and radiance, but just blinding darkness prevails. But when the sun and moon arise in the world, then there is the manifestation of great light and radiance. So, as long as a Tathagata has not arisen in the world, for so long there is no manifestation of great light and radiance, but then there is just darkness, the darkness, but then there is just blinding darkness, a great mass of darkness, and so long there is no explaining, search, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, and so on of the Four Noble Truths. But when the Tathagata arises in the world, then there is this manifestation of great light and radiance, that is the explaining, teaching, proclaiming, establishing, and so on of the Four Noble Truths. And so this particular sutta comes in the chapter of the Samyutta Nikaya on the Four Noble Truths, and it indicates that the special function of the Buddha is to proclaim, to analyze, to expound the Four Noble Truths to the world. Okay, the next sutta also shows the function of a Buddha by way of a simile, and this is a simile which revolves around the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, this is a simile which uses as its term of analogy a herd of deer. So there's a marsh where a herd of deer is dwelling, and then a man comes along who wishes to harm them, perhaps a hunter who wants to kill them. And so he will close off the good path that leads to safety, and he opens up a false path. He puts out a decoy and sets up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come to calamity, disaster, and loss. But then another man comes along who desires the welfare and protection of the deer. He reopens the safe path. He blocks off the false path. He removes the decoy. He destroys the dummy. So later this herd of deer can walk to safety, and they will grow, increase, and live safely. And so then the Buddha explains the meaning of the simile. The low-lying marshland, that is the term for sensual pleasures. The herd of deer are sentient beings. The man desiring their harm is Mara. The false path is the wrong eightfold path, the wrong view and so on to wrong concentration. The decoy is delight and lust, and the dummy is a term for ignorance. There's a book, Buddhism for Dummies, isn't there? Okay, then the man desiring their good welfare and protection, this is a term for the Buddha. And the good, the safe and good path to be traveled joyfully, this is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path. And so the function of the Buddha here is to block off the wrong path, the path that is endorsed by Mara, and to open up the Noble Eightfold Path so that sentient beings following this path can emerge from danger and reach the goal of safety and security, Nibbana. Okay, the next text also uses a simile. Now we're back to the simile of the lion. The lion comes out from his cave, stretches himself and roars. His lions roar three times. When he roars, then all of the other animals living in the jungle are afraid and run away. Even the bull elephants living in the towns get so frightened that they break their bonds and they run amok. And so the Buddha says, when the Tathagata arises in the world, then he teaches the Dhamma thus. This is form, this is its origin, this is its passing away, such as feeling, perception, volitions, consciousness, such their origin, such their passing away. And when that's the Buddha roaring his lion's roar, and when he does so, then even the devas living with long lifespans, living in the highest heavens, when they hear the Tathagata teaching, the Dhamma, then they are filled with fear, a sense of urgency and terror, thinking, we thought that we were permanent, but we're actually impermanent. We thought that we were stable or everlasting, but we are unstable, transient. It seems that we thought ourselves eternal, but we're transient. So it seems that we are impermanent, unstable, transient, and included within identity. Identity is the five aggregates. Okay, so this illustrates the Buddha with the simile of the lion. Then we come to the last text, and this text deals with the question, why is he called the Tathagata? The word Tathagata, it comes from, the exact meaning isn't really understood, but it's a derivative. Its derivation can be understood in two ways. It can be derived either from tatta. The word tatta means thus or such, and agata means come. So he could be called the Tathagata because he has come in such a way. But it can also be derived from tatta plus gata. Gata means gone. So Tathagata as thus gone is one who has gone in such a way. So the commentaries take it to mean that he is one who has come thus, that is in the same way that all of the Buddhas of the past have come, by perfecting the 10 paramis and by perfecting all of the factors of enlightenment. And one who has gone thus, who has gone in the way that all enlightened ones in the past have gone, by developing the Noble Eightfold Path, developing the four jhanas, developing the insight knowledges, developing the knowledges of the paths and fruits. Okay, so this sutta gives a number of explanations why the Buddha is called the Tathagata, though it doesn't really quite explain the term etymologically by way of its components. Okay, so he says the world has been fully awakened to or fully understood by the Tathagata. The Tathagata is detached from the world, because he's cut off all of the fetters that bind him to the world. The origin of the world has been fully awakened to by the Tathagata. The origin of the world, according to the Buddha, is craving. This doesn't mean that craving creates the external world, but what is meant by the world is the world of our experience, that is the world of the five aggregates. And so the five aggregates are repeatedly brought into being by craving together with ignorance. And so that is the origin of the world. And the Buddha says that he is fully awakened to the origin of the world. And he has abandoned the origin of the world. He's cut off all craving and ignorance. And so for him, there will be no more manifestation of a world. The cessation of the world has been fully awakened to by the Tathagata. The cessation of the world is Nibbana. And the Tathagata has realized the cessation of the world. Then the way to the cessation of the world has been fully awakened to by the Tathagata, and the Tathagata has developed the way to the cessation of the world. The way to the cessation of the world is the Noble Eightfold Path, or the 37 Aids to Enlightenment. Okay, then he continues, in the world with its devas, mara, brahma, in this population with its ascetics and brahmins, with its devas and humans, whatever there is that is seen, heard, sensed, cognized, reached, sought after, examined by the mind, all that has been awakened to by the Tathagata. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. Here, when the Buddha says that he is awakened to everything seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, again, I don't think that this implies that we have to understand this to mean that the Buddha knows every fact about the world through all periods of time, so that the Buddha will have known 500 BC how to use an iPod that wouldn't be developed until the year 2005 of the common era. Or that the Buddha will understand how many particles of dust there might be in Kuan Yin Hall now, or how many ants there might be hiding under Taishu Hall. But the way I would understand this passage is that the Buddha has understood the essential nature of everything seen, heard, sensed, cognized, and so on. Okay, next, from the night that he was fully awakened until the night he attains final nibbana, in this period, whatever the Buddha speaks, talks of, and expounds, all that is just so, not otherwise. Here the text actually uses the word tattang, not avitattang. So the word tatang is related to the word tata, thus, just so. Okay, next, as he speaks, so he does. That is, he acts in accordance with his speech. And as he does, so he speaks. That is, he teaches in accordance with his own actions, his own behavior. And since he does as he speaks and speaks as he acts, therefore he is called the Tathagata. Okay, then, in this world with its devas, with its mara, with brahma, in this population with its ascetics and brahmins, its devas and humans, the Tathagata is the vanquisher, the unvanquished, the universal seer, the wielder of mastery. Therefore, he is called the Tathagata. The qualities that the Buddha is ascribing to himself here, these are the qualities that, this is actually the formula that the Brahmins used to describe Brahma. They regarded Brahma, they first would call Brahma the creator, the fashioner of the world. But the Buddha doesn't claim to be a creator or fashioner of the world. But he takes the other terms in that description. He is the vanquisher in the sense that he's vanquished all the defilements, all delusions. Unvanquished, he was undefeated by Mara and by all of the hordes of Mara's followers. He's the universal seer in that he understands all of the truths. the wielder of mastery and that he's gained mastery over his own mind. And so therefore he is called the Tathagata. And then this sutta concludes with very beautiful and inspiring set of verses in praise of the Buddha. I won't read these out loud, but you can read these on your own. Okay, and so with this we conclude the chapter and the book. But now I'll ask first whether there are any questions on anything that was covered just today. Then what I'm going to do is to, after that, is to give a brief overview of the structure or pattern of the whole book, and then ask if there's any questions on anything that we've covered throughout this course. Okay, so please, if you have any questions. Do we have that floating microphone? Usually somebody. So any questions?
I have a question about the powers and grounds of self-confidence.
Yes.
In the latter part of the Buddha, where they discuss the four other qualities, they're all sort of stated in the negative.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the reason for that formulation, as opposed to these are the qualities he does have, as opposed to these are the ones, this is what he does not embody?
I think the reason is that you see, these are called grounds of self-confidence. So the confidence is that nobody could challenge him on these points by saying that he lacks, that he hasn't fully awakened to all dharmas as they are, that he hasn't destroyed all defilements, that the things that he calls obstructions, nobody could say that they are not obstructions, and nobody could say that his teaching will not lead to the destruction of suffering for one who practices it. So his confidence is that nobody can challenge him on those points. So that's why it's expressed in a negative way.
So it's anticipating people's objections to him being called.
Yeah.
The question is about the 10th power of the knowledge of Tathagata.
The 10 what?
The 10th power.
The 10th Tathagata powers.
The 10th one.
Oh, the 10th one.
Yeah, in what way does an arahant have not yet fully developed the 10th power of the knowledge of the Tathagata?
No, those. The 10th one is actually shared by arahats with the Tathagata. There's no way in which the arahat is deficient with regard to the knowledge of the destruction of the taints.
For the first 9 powers, an arahat has not yet fully developed them. Only the 10th one.
Well, let's say in the text we find many arhats also have the recollection of past lives and the knowledge of the divine eye, the ability to know the passing away and rebirth of beings. Probably in the case of the Buddha, that those two knowledges will have a wider range than for the arhat disciples. And they'll be able to function more speedily, so that they could occur for the Buddha instantaneously if he wants to know something that occurred in one of his own past lives, or if he wants to see the rebirth, the passing away and rebirth of another being. So those two, the arhats have in common with the Buddha, but probably not to the same extent. But the 10th power of knowledge is shared equally by the Buddhas and the arhats.
There's no slight difference at all in terms of the text power.
As far as the canonical texts go, there's no difference. Later texts from a later period introduce something called the vasana. This is what's in Chinese Shichi? Is this the Shichi? Is that the... Okay, the vasana is supposed to be a tendency towards a particular type of behavior which normally, that habitual pattern, it's created by a defilement, but it can continue after the defilement is eliminated. To give some examples, okay, it said that there's a case of one arhat disciple of the Buddha, I think his name was Pindola Bharadvaja. No, not Pindola Bharadvaja. Vacha Palinda Vacha, I forgot the name, he's mentioned in the Udana, but he would refer to other monks as Vasala, which is a derogatory term that Brahmins would use to refer to those of the lower classes. And so other monks came to the Buddha and complained that this monk was going around calling other people, other monks, Vasala. And then the Buddha said, don't criticize him, he's an arhant. But in so many past lives, he had been a high caste Brahmin. And so he had this habit of calling other people Vasala. And so he still hasn't gotten rid of that habit, even though he's destroyed the defilements. But I have to say, it strikes me that the stories, this comes in the Udana. It's one of the shorter texts of the miscellaneous collection. And it strikes me that the story portion of the Udana comes from a somewhat later period than the oldest texts of the Nikayas. And to me, it doesn't seem conceivable that somebody who is an arhat will refer to another person by a derogatory term. It just doesn't seem very convincing. It seems almost as though this was an artificial story created just to bring out a certain point. Okay, there's another story that comes in the commentary, I think, that one monk would sometimes skip when crossing a little stream of water. Instead of walking with apparent mindfulness and dignity, he would skip across the little stream of water. And so some monks complained to the Buddha about that monk. And the Buddha said, don't complain about this monk. He is one of the true disciples who has reached the stage of the destruction of the defilements. He is an arhat. But in so many past lives, he had been a monkey. And so he had developed as a monkey this habit of skipping across water. And so this habit of skipping across water is referred to as a vasana, a habitual tendency. Again, I don't find this story particularly convincing. And it comes in the commentary, so one could put a question mark around it. But these types of behaviors are used to illustrate the presence of vasanas, certain habits that have not yet been, that have not been eradicated, even though the defilements that caused those habits in the first place have been eliminated. And so it's said that the Buddha is one who has eradicated all defilements together with the vasanas, with all of these sort of unseemly or undignified behavior patterns, whereas those who are the arhat disciples can still have certain unseemly, undecorous behavior patterns, even though they've eliminated all the defilements.
Last sutta you just went over, the part about the Tathagata speaks, so he does, as he does, so he speaks. Is the main point here about the Tathagata being a honest and a person who just doesn't say anything otherwise. Is that the main point here?
Yeah.
It's just simple.
No, I think the main point is that the Buddha acts in accordance with his teaching, so that he doesn't act in a way that's contrary to his teaching. Probably in the Buddha's time, even today, there are many like prominent gurus who teach one thing, you know, say, love everybody, you should have a mind that's able to accept everybody. But then in their, you know, private quarters, you know, if somebody is criticizing them, they might say to one of the disciples, it would be good if we get this one kicked out of the community. He's just a troublemaker. Get rid of him. And even, you know, there are gurus who preach celibacy, you know, purity regarding sexual conduct, and yet secretly they might have mistresses. Teachers who proclaim peace, non-injury, non-violence, and yet behind the scenes they are instigating violence against those who criticize them. So the point is that the Buddha, in teaching principles like non-violence, honesty, truthfulness, and so on, is one who acts in accordance with those teachings. Yeah, please.
The question about the self-confidence.
About the self-confidence.
Self-confidence, yeah. I think I raised the question a few several weeks ago,
yeah,
when we had the intrepidity of lay people.
Yeah.
At that time, the meaning was like a who could become independent of others. And I believe the word intrepidity at that time,
yeah,
and also self-confidence here,
yeah,
is the same.
It's the same word, yeah, yeah.
So, and then I don't think I heard of a good explanation from you how I could actually understand why, how you can use that for lay people who are not even stream enterer. So, can you explain a little further? Because the intrepidity is also used on, actually on page 388, on top, the lay people. It's about,
yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is actually the same word.
So
I think I later decided to change the translation because the word intrepidity is a very bookish word, which is not, doesn't resonate with people.
So, in other words, the word hesaraja,
yeah,
that it doesn't really necessarily mean it only can be used for Tathagata.
Oh, it's not exclusive to the Tathagata, no. In this case, what is meant by the disciple here who has gained intrepidity or gained self-confidence, this is not just the ordinary self-confidence of somebody who is like, you know, the aggressive salesperson or the aspiring politician who's confident in himself, but this means that the person has gained self-confidence with regard to the Buddha's teaching, that they are able to expound the teaching, that nobody could shake their confidence in the teaching because they have experienced and directly realized the truth of the teaching for themselves. And so when they speak about the teaching, they speak on the basis of their own experience, their own realization. That is the sense here.
On the impasse you say a little bit more about the impossibility of something done with good intent having bad results? Because I'm pretty familiar with, you know, people who meant well,
yeah,
and things yeah. Don't turn out well.
Yeah. If something is done with good intention, that intention, in terms of the working of karma, will bring good results for the one who does it. Because the motivation is a good motivation.
I see.
Yeah, but it often happens that what we do with good intention might sometimes bring bad results in the course of events. But that is not our volition. You see, the karmic result is depends upon the volition or intention with which the action is done. So if one acts with good intention, then the karmic results will have to be results that are beneficial or that are agreeable and pleasant. But it might be that in terms of the working of causes and conditions in the outer world, that what's done with good intention might lead to bad results. Any further questions? Okay, then I'll do a sort of comprehensive overview. Okay, so what I tried to do in this book is to find a systematic way to organize all of the teachings of the Buddha found in the Pali Nikayas, to put them into some kind of comprehensive structure. Because the texts that occur in the Nikayas themselves are not organized in any kind of meaningful sequence. And so if one just picks up a complete Nikaya, it's a little bewildering to find oneself to find one's way through it, to try to find what is the pattern that underlies the teaching. So here I try to use one scheme with numerous subdivisions as a way of organizing the teaching. So the basic scheme that I used, well, I'll introduce that a little bit later, but first I had three preliminary chapters. The first chapter is called The Human Condition, and the purpose of this chapter is to take a survey, or to present a survey of the human condition, the way it is viewed in the Nikayas, to look at the human condition as it might look to the Bodhisattva when he's dwelling in the Tusita heaven before he descends into the world to enter upon the process leading to Buddhahood. So we're trying to see what are the particular problems in the life in the world that the Buddha's teaching is intended to address. So that is the subject of the first chapter, the human condition from the standpoint of the Nikayas. What is the suffering, the unsatisfactoriness of the human condition? Why is it that a Buddha has to appear in the world to achieve enlightenment? And what are the problems that his enlightenment are intended to resolve? Okay, then from chapter one, we come to chapter two, which is a compressed biography of the Buddha, which stitches together a number of texts which trace the career of the Buddha from the time of his conception, or even going back before the conception, to his sojourn in the Tusita heaven, then through his conception, his birth, his quest for enlightenment, the attainment of enlightenment, then his decision to teach, and the first discourse. The third chapter, again it's a preparatory chapter, deals with what I call the approach to the Dhamma. what are the distinctive characteristics of the Buddha's teaching? How can somebody who has not been born and brought up in a Buddhist environment, what is the proper attitude for them to take when they approach the teaching? And this is basically an attitude of inquiry, investigation, experimentation to test the teaching for oneself, and to examine even the Buddha as the teacher for himself. But to examine even the Buddha, the teacher, himself. Okay, with chapter 4, we come to the scheme that I've tried to use to organize all of the teachings. And I use this by, the scheme that I use is based upon a sequence of three types of happiness or benefit to which the Buddha's teaching is intended to lead. These three levels of happiness, we can see them occasionally mentioned within the text, but they're laid out more schematically in the commentaries. The three levels are well-being and happiness in this present life. This is referring to happiness in the mundane spheres of human existence. Then happiness and well-being in the future life. And then the ultimate well-being and happiness, the happiness of liberation, of nibbana. Okay, so when we take the happiness visible in this present life, this pertains to how the Buddha's teaching is intended to apply to human society and human relationships. So we find that the Buddha gives many basic ethical teachings which relate to, or which pertain to the relations between parents and children, children, the attitude of children to their parents, which apply to the relations between husbands and wives, teachings concerned with right livelihood, teachings concerned with communal harmony, how a community could live together in harmony, how it can achieve social stability, and also principles by which the ruler should rule his kingdom. Principles concerning especially the preventing poverty in the kingdom and ensuring that everybody has a satisfactory standard of living. Okay, these teachings on well-being and happiness in this present life form the foundation, the necessary foundation for progress in the Dhamma. Because it's only when there's some degree of social stability, social harmony, that one can practice the Dhamma happily and successfully without having to worry constantly about oppression by the government, by friction and dissension in family relationships, and so on. So on the basis of well-being and happiness in this present life, then one undertakes the practices that lead to a fortunate rebirth. And so in this chapter I introduce the principles that underlie this teaching about the way to a fortunate rebirth. This is the teaching on karma and rebirth. And then within this chapter we find the main principles or teachings that lead to a happy rebirth, the teachings that teach us how to create meritorious karma, that is the practice of giving, the practice of moral discipline, and then the more foundational types of meditation, particularly the meditation of the four Brahmaviharas or divine abodes, and of the four divine abodes, the one that the Buddha teaches most extensively is the development of metta, or loving kindness. Okay, chapter 6 is what I call a transitional chapter, and the purpose of this chapter is to prepare the way to the chapters that are concerned with the ultimate good, with the path to liberation. So this chapter is called Deepening One's Perspective on the World, And so the point of the teachings in this chapter is to show the unsatisfactoriness of all states of being within the world. So even the heavens for the Buddha are not the final goal. So the Buddha points out, he uses a scheme of three perspectives, which are gratification, what is the happiness and enjoyment in the world, the danger, what is the unsatisfactoriness or potential misery in worldly life, and then escape or release, what is the way to release from these dangers and disadvantages of worldly life. And so this chapter focuses upon the aspect of danger. What are the dangers or pitfalls and sensual pleasures, the transience of life, the inevitability of death, the danger in wrong views, and the broad, extensive danger of samsara, the stream or the sequence of birth and death. Okay, so from this chapter, we then come to the chapters concerned with liberation, the ultimate good. And the first of these lays out the path to liberation. This gives a broad overview of the path, taking the Noble Eightfold Path as well as the gradual training that the Buddha has laid out for the monastics, but which also applies to anybody in a general way. The scheme, basic scheme of moral discipline, concentration, wisdom, culminating in liberation. Okay, chapter 7 deals with the path in a very broad and general way, but then in chapter 8, I focus in more in greater detail on what might be called the pivot of the path, which is the development of the mind, the mastery of the mind. So here we deal with the process of developing serenity and insight, the two aspects of Buddhist meditation. So we looked at the hindrances to mental development, how the mind has to be gradually refined, how to remove distracting thoughts, some of the subjects of meditation. And then I dealt at length with the sutta on the four establishments of mindfulness and with mindfulness of breathing. Okay, even though in chapter 8 we deal with the methods for developing insight or wisdom, but in that chapter we didn't deal with the content of what is to be investigated and understood through wisdom. So the purpose of chapter 9 is to present in much more detail what I call the domain of wisdom, what one is to investigate and what one has to realize with wisdom. Okay, this is laid out in a somewhat broad way in the discourse on right view, which deals extensively with the Four Noble Truths and with the formula of dependent origination. But then in the fourth section of this chapter, we dealt with all of these different topics that come under the heading of wisdom. The five aggregates, the six sense bases, the elements, 18 elements, 4 elements, 6 elements, and then dependent origination, culminating in the Four Noble Truths and the nature of the goal, Nibbana. Okay, then the attainment of wisdom occurs in stages, and when it reaches a particular stage, a particular point of development, then wisdom brings a transition from the stage of being a worldly person to the stage of being a noble one, an Aryan, one who is definitely on the way, irreversibly on the way, to final liberation. So The 10th chapter deals with these planes of realization. And so first I made a broad overview of the stages of liberation, and then I dealt in greater detail with several of these key stages. First, the attainment of stream entry, which marks the entrance upon this irreversible path to liberation. Then the stage of non-returning, where one is bound to achieve rebirth in one of the higher divine realms, never returning to this world. And then the stage of Arhat, who is the person who has achieved final liberation in this life itself. And then amongst all of the Arhats, the supreme Arhat, the first one to achieve Arhatship, is the Buddha himself, the Tathagata. So in the last section of the book, we deal with the specific, unique qualities of the Tathagata. And so that is the summary of the book. Okay, so if any of you have any questions on anything that's been covered, anything that has provoked your curiosity, only about Buddhism though, then please feel welcome to ask. Okay, the concept of the expression bodhisattva is used in the early texts by the Buddha in reference to himself. It's extended back to his previous life as when he was a deity dwelling in the Tusita heaven. He refers to himself as a bodhisattva there. And then after he takes rebirth into the human realm, he speaks about his period before his enlightenment as the time when he was a bodhisattva. We find at least one sutta in the Digha Nikaya where the Buddha speaks about the Buddhas of the past, the seven Buddhas, six Buddhas of the past, and he refers to them before their enlightenment as a bodhisattva. I think this also occurs in the Samyutta Nikaya. And so we have here the use of the word bodhisattva used by the Buddha to refer to somebody who's going to become a Buddha in the early period of his life or in the life immediately before that. Okay, but then this concept of bodhisattva became, let's say, elaborated over several generations after the Buddha's passing away, till the idea took root that the bodhisattva forms his aspiration to become a Buddha in some earlier life under an earlier Buddha, in the time of, according to some of these texts, the person or the being who is to become Gautama Buddha, the Buddha of our era, formed his vow to achieve Buddhahood under an earlier Buddha called Dipankara. And then from that point on, he became a bodhisattva, engaged in the practice of the paramis in life after life until he had perfected these paramis, these supreme virtues, to the point where he was ready to achieve Buddhahood. Okay, so once this idea emerged and was elaborated and explored, then the idea took root that other people too can form aspirations to become Buddhas in the future, even without getting a prediction from a Buddha. And so in this way, a bodhisattva ideal circulated first probably in the early Buddha schools until there emerged certain Buddhist communities which focused exclusively on the bodhisattva path, and then that became the nucleus for the emergence of what we now call Mahayana Buddhism.
In the early use, when you had said that the Buddha referred to himself as a bodhisattva,
yeah,
this is in that reference, is someone that's already entered the stream entry, you know, or is it just a practitioner that aspires to be that bodhisattva? Or, you know?
Yeah, it's not somebody who has achieved stream entry, but it's somebody, apparently it's somebody who is going to achieve Buddhahood, which means that he will achieve the full enlightenment at a time when there's no other Buddha teaching in the world, and when the Buddha's teaching is not known in the world. So the Bodhisattva then becomes the precursor for the attainment of Buddhahood, as the one who discovers the Dhamma in the world and then makes it known for the first time in a particular historical period in the world.
According to the Theravada traditions, what kind of connection can we make to with that historical Buddha, except for studying his teachings, which were that more than 2,000 years ago, and to practice according to the method? Is there anyone or any entity at the other end when we recite Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Buddhasa at the beginning of each class? It seems to me there is no one there.
So you're asking, is there somebody there who is listening? And
yeah, is there any kind of connection that we can establish? Because it's so different from Mahayana tradition. So I wonder if that recitation is just a kind of self, it's an aspiration to remind myself. And actually, there's nothing to do with anybody or anything.
It's like making a telephone call with nobody at the other end of the telephone. The person is moved, so nobody answers the phone. Actually, the way I've seen it in the actual Theravada tradition, the way it's practiced in Sri Lanka, even though one conceptually or cognitively doesn't believe that there's anybody answering the telephone, but one acts and feels as though there is somebody answering the answering the telephone. Wait, I'll elaborate once I get the laughing out of my system. The way I understand it is that it's believed that once the Buddha passes away and goes into Nibbana, as an individual with a consciousness, with perception, and so on, he's no longer there picking up on what we're doing in this world. But the way I understand it, and I'm expressing an idea which might not be conceptually expressed in the Theravada tradition in quite these terms, but a Buddha sets up what we might call a vibrational field, a field of spiritual energy, which remains as long as the Dhamma exists in the world, though it is seen to become progressively weaker over time. And so when one practices devotion to the Buddha, either through ideas in one's mind or through representations of the Buddha, the Buddha images, or stupas, chaityas, dagavas, or relics of the Buddha, one is in a sense connecting with that field of vibrational spiritual energy which the Buddha has set up, and one is tapping into that spiritual energy and calling it within into oneself. And so in this way, one sort of participates in the spiritual energy field created by a Buddha and is able to tap that energy field for as a kind of power that sustains one in one's practice and that helps one in one's progress. So this is my own interpretation of what takes place. And so it might not be all that different from, at least, say in Mahayana Buddhism, of course Amitabha Buddha is believed to be a Buddha who still exists in another world system. But how about Shakyamuni Buddha? It's believed Buddha has gone into nirvana. So he's not existing in nirvana looking down at us, knowing what's going on. But for those who are not devoted to Amitabha Buddha, but to Shakyamuni Buddha, what is the benefit that they're getting? Does it come from Shakyamuni Buddha looking down and conferring benefits on them? Or by tapping into the vibrational energy field of Shakyamuni Buddha?
Can I just ask a follow-up question?
Yeah.
You said that the vibrational field exists as long as Dhamma exists.
Yeah.
Can you give me a precise definition of the Dhamma here?
Well, this would be the Dhamma as the Buddha's teaching, so that one could tap into this vibrational field of the Buddha that the Buddha sets up, as long as, say, the Buddha is known and the qualities of the Buddha are known, and that one has devotion to the Buddha as the one who teaches the Dhamma. Dhamma in the sense of the law of the universe that always exists.
Even if the content of the so-called Buddha's Dhamma is changing from tradition to tradition, as long as people have this devotion to Buddha in general, that qualifies this vibrational field's existence. Is that right?
I would say so.
Okay.
But please remember, though, that this idea of the vibrational field, it's my own attempt to conceptualize what seems to be going on in the Theravada tradition. And we have some words which correspond to this idea of vibrational field. Like we chant, say at the end of a devotional service, Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba buddhanu bhavena sadasoti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba dhammanu bhavena sadasoti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalang rakantu sabba devata sabba sanghanu bhavena sadasoti bhavantu te. Okay, the first verse we're saying sabba buddhanu bhavena sadasoti bhavantu te. It's by the spiritual power, there's this word anubhava, by the spiritual power of all the Buddhas, may you have safety, may you be safe. So this spiritual power of the Buddhas, the Buddha passes away. In fact, it says sabba buddhanu bhavena. So maybe the spiritual power of the Buddhas exists even after, say, the Dhamma of Kassapa Buddha, the Dhamma of Vipassi Buddha have passed away. But as long as those Buddhas are known, their names are known, and they're called to mind, their spiritual power is still available. So probably through their paramitas, their loving kindness, their compassion, they set moving these waves of spiritual power. And so they pass away, but the spiritual power remains, especially invested in certain objects like the Bodhi trees, relics, stupas, Buddha images. But even without depending upon these external objects, just through recollecting the Buddha and his qualities, one connects to that spiritual power. And also I have to say, I've felt the spiritual power myself in certain very sacred places, whether it's created by the place itself or by the mental power of all of the people who come there to express devotion. But even one time, this was 1982, when I first went back to Sri Lanka, I was looking for the Bodhi tree in Anuradhapura. I saw this little temple, and I, just out of curiosity, I went into this little temple, And there was like a real powerful current, almost like electrical vibrations in the air. And I thought, wow, it's really powerful in this little temple. Then I went out that little temple from the other door, and I saw this little temple was the temple between the street and the Bodhi tree. The Bodhi tree was just on the other side of that little temple. And so that was the source of that power that I was experiencing.
I have some questions about the term Dhamma Vichaya, which is sometimes translated as investigation of phenomena.
Yeah.
Sometimes you use the term, I think, in your translation sometimes, discrimination.
Yeah.
One question about it is what's the reason, the nuances of the different translations, because investigation, discrimination mean different things.
Yeah.
And another question really is, in formal practice of sitting, there is sort of experiential investigation that can go on.
Yeah.
But you sit in mindfulness, you bring forth mindfulness and establish mindfulness, but what would you use to describe the distinction between sort of the mindfulness and the insights that arise and the investigation itself?
Oh, these are big questions. Okay, for the first question. Yeah, most translators for Dhamma Vichaya have used investigation of, sometimes they've used investigation of the Dhamma, sometimes investigation of Dhammas, because from the compound one can't tell whether Dhamma is intended to be singular, the teaching, or plural, phenomena, or even mental states. But the way I've seen the explanation given, even in the suttas, it indicates that it is to be taken as plural, as the mental states. And the reason why I had used discrimination is that the way the sutta defines it, it seems to involve making a distinction between certain mental qualities. It said that I don't see the passage that I had in mind in here. But he speaks about, in other suttas, about distinguishing what states are wholesome, what are unwholesome, what are blameless, what are blameworthy, what are the dark and bright dhammas and their qualities. So I wanted to use the word discrimination because I wanted to make clear that at a certain point the practice of Dhamma Vichaya involves making a distinction among these qualities. And the way I see it, the role of Dhamma Vichaya, the question comes to me, why is it placed after mindfulness? If we take it to be discrimination in the sense of wisdom, or investigation in the sense of wisdom, it should come later in the process. But it comes right after mindfulness and even before energy. So it seems to me that what takes place first, one tries to establish a base of mindfulness, any of the four foundations of mindfulness. While one is establishing the mindfulness, one is able to observe one's mental states. And so at that point, one then has to be able to distinguish which mental states are unwholesome, what are the states related to the five hindrances, and which are wholesome, which are the states that are leading to concentration and insight. And then one has to use energy or effort to remove the unwholesome states and to strengthen and fortify the wholesome states. And so that's the way I understand the initial function of discrimination of Dhamma Vichaya. But then what I would say is that Dhamma Vichaya continues, in a sense, all the ways through, and then it becomes the particular quality, particular enlightenment factor that brings the arising of wisdom when it then investigates things like the five aggregates to see impermanence, suffering, non-self. I'm getting a little hint. That there's going to be a service to take place. And so we should end our class and the course. I'm just curious, who was present for the course from the very beginning? That's a fair number have been through the whole course from the beginning to end. And who came during the course? Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. All the merits from, I think it was September 2007. It's a much bigger vibrational field. All the ways till October 2009. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabumata deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chiram rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Etavata ca amhehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Bhavagupadhaya vichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, and please remember that the new course will begin on October 17th, and that will be course based on the middle-length discourses of the Buddha, the Majjhima Nikaya. If you can purchase the book called The Middle-Length of Discourses of the Buddha, then I recommend it. But maybe some people have trouble with it. It's about $40, the book. It's worth it. But what I will do probably is send each sutta sometime in advance to the Baus website, and so you could then download it and print it out if you don't want to buy the book. Okay, so we end with three Baus.